Hello, friends, and welcome to the Optimized Advisor Podcast, where we focus on optimizing the well-being and best practices of insurance and financial professionals today. On this show, our objective is to help you optimize your life, optimize your profession, and learn from other Optimized Advisors. I'm your host, Scott Heinola. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello, Richard Boone. Welcome to the Optimized Advisor Podcast today. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Scott. Thank you so much for having me here. It's a real pleasure.
It is. It's a pleasure for me as well. I was introduced to you recently through some other advisors and a broker-dealer firm that we do business with, and you and I have been in fast conversation since.
Exactly.
Looking forward to sharing a little bit more about your history, your organization, Ideal Plan Coaching, what that means, what you do for advisors, and a few specific areas that we want to focus on today. Is one is helping advisors kind of build a plan around their business, not just a business plan, but the ancillary really needs that advisors are really required to have today, right? To be optimal in their practice. Mm-hmm. There's some things that advisors do very well, almost second nature to them, but then there's also challenges that they're faced with, right? So how do we help them make those a little bit more proficient and bring to light some of the areas of expertise and some of the challenges that they just kind of naturally face as practitioners to be more optimal and be more successful in their practice? And then you in your process, which we'll get into, you've got this really interesting page on your Ideal Plan process, which you'll explain, but compare your business optimization responses versus top responses. So I wanted to delve into that a little bit of what you're seeing advisors answer particular questions that are very common, and unpack that a little bit, dive into those.
Sounds great. Yeah, we can start wherever you'd like.
So first and foremost, why don't you just talk to us a little bit about your career, your tenure, and specifically Ideal Plan Coaching and what it does today.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, long story short, which I say that a lot, so I hope you can bear with me and maybe edit that out on occasion. But what I like to do is I do like to start at the beginning, because without a little bit of understanding kind of where I came from, might be kind of unusual why or how I even got into coaching. I did things backward. Most advisors or most coaches started out as an advisor and went out and did all the things that all advisors do when they're brand new. I waited almost 12 years before I became an advisor on my own. And I loved what I was doing. I actually started out as like a glorified intern while I was still in college, working in an advisory office. And what it did is it taught me a lot of not only what the industry was about, but I think there's a lot of empathy, for lack of another word, that you have to have for financial advisors. You have to understand how tough it is to really help them. And for 12 years, that's what I was doing. I was helping financial advisors be successful. So you could, on one hand, argue that's really great training for being a coach. On the other hand, you hadn't bled, or eat screen, as my friend used to say long ago, when you went door knocking, cold walking and pounding on doors, trying to get somebody to open the door and they'd slam the screen in your face. I hadn't eaten screen yet, as he said.
Right.
And until you get out there and kind of put your name on the building, right? Put your name on the wall that says, hey, I'm Rich Boone, financial advisor. Until you do that, you just don't get it. It's like a man trying to express what it's like to have a baby. Good luck with that, right? You can read it, you can study it, but you don't know it, and you never will. So one of the reasons why I went into the business in the first place as an advisor was to experience it, mm-hmm. and to see how I could do. And honestly, I did do well. I liked it, but I found that I liked working with advisors a lot more. Yeah. So back to the original premise, long story short, a little late for that, but here we go. I started out as a support person working for a financial advisor, had been in the business, I don't know, maybe 10 years, something like that. When I started working with him, I was in college. I was, a junior in college, I guess. And a friend of mine I ran into at the San Jose State Spartan Student Center or whatever it was, Student Union, whatever we called it back then. And I ran into him and we just were talking and he said, hey, you know, are you happen to be looking for a job? And, you know, next thing you know, I get an interview and I'm in this office ultimately, and there's about 35 or 40 financial advisors. They were kind of a super OSJ. They were a big, they had 90 or 100 altogether, but, you know, 35 or so in that office. So it was kind of like diving into the deep end in terms of exposure to the industry. And you had, you know, the top producers in the great big offices in the corners, and you had everybody else kind of, you know, in between, and the newbies kind of off in the corner. And I discovered that bottom line is that a lot of these guys, no matter how much they try to help each other, you're still on your own. You're still on your own, right? Yeah. It's still you paying the bills.
On an island.
You're on an island.
Yeah.
And, you know, to go back to the word empathy, I know it's thrown around a lot, but I kind of realized a lot of these guys were kind of scared almost, you know, the ones that hadn't built it yet, hadn't made it yet. And you're staring at a mortgage and maybe you got a family to support. That's a tough place to be, you know, and it's not just our industry. It's any industry,
right?
You know, anything you're starting from scratch can really scare you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you don't meet with success fairly quickly, what are you going to do about it?
Right.
So all of this is kind of foundational to why I started my own firm. Fast forward, you know, many years later, I discovered that if I could provide a system, a process to make it really, really easy for a guy to, or gal, anybody that's going in this business or is already in it for 20 years, I don't care how long you've been here. If I can make it easy for you to know exactly what to do next, and I can provide you the solution, I can provide you the tools, the content, the support.
Right.
Maybe I'm helping. Right. That's how I earn my space in the sun, if you will.
Yeah. So, Ideal Plan Coaching was born, and you and I've had in-depth conversation regarding, the company and some of the resources that you make available. It starts really with the Ideal Plan Builder.
Yeah. The purpose, the Ideal Plan Builder is, you know, really just an acronym, IDEAL, you know, identify, determine, evaluate, assess, leverage. So one at a time, identify, where are you now? Where do you want to be? What's your vision, right? What is your business supposed to look like in your mind? How many advisors have been kind of told what they should be doing rather than discovered it themselves? And I found out a long time ago, people just don't want to be sold something. They don't want to be pushed into something. They don't, if it isn't their idea, they're just probably not going to love it. They may do it, but they don't love it. So one of the things I like to do, and I'm working with some people, is simply just do a little bit of, you know, almost like creating a vision. What do you want your business to really look like? Now, that's kind of hard to do online unless you just put in a heck of a lot of choices, right? And so if somebody goes to my Ideal Plan Builder, it's just an online tool, but it'll help them to start clicking buttons, you know, production, kinds of clients, target market, all the things that are kind of foundational to your business.
Yeah.
Then we want to determine your business model, because your business model ultimately supports or it fights your vision. You can be a general advisor, you can be a financial planner, wealth manager, family office. I look at them as each having some pros and cons, advantages, disadvantages, but you have to know what you want to build in order to understand the business model.
Right.
So once you make that choice, then we can start evaluating what we call your skills or your proficiencies in the seven, what I call critical business elements.
Yeah. If we could pause there for a moment, just talk about the identify. It's so true that I think in many cases, and this is in the case of any business, a lot of the times out of the gate, we're in full survival mode. I mean, that is our first stage as an entrepreneur, as a business. The life cycle begins with survival. We need to get to the point where we're now sustainable. And in some cases, I end up in that journey to survive. I get to a point now of significance where I need to pause, take a look at my business. Who are the clients we're serving? What are the products we're representing? Where do we exist in the marketplace? And is it in alignment with what I really want to achieve, what my real vision is? And sometimes we just get so fogged up and muddied without taking a step back, looking at it from, you know, a 1,000-foot overview And sometimes we see, whoa, we've gotten way off course in a short amount of time, or off course enough to where if I keep going down this path, I'm going to end up being in a completely different realm, revenue generating process. I'm going to be a completely different practice than what I originally set out to accomplish. So we got to kind of recalibrate that. We got to figure out where we are, where we ultimately want to go. And that could require significant adjustments, right?
It can be painful too, to be fair.
Thank you for saying it.
The analogy I have, you know, for what you just described, you know, the whole idea that, you know, you kind of end up on this different path is, somebody said this to me a long time ago. I can't remember who it was, but they said, it's like if you were in charge, let's say you're a general manager of a football team, NFL, and you're in charge of draft, right? And you decide day one, we want nothing but really big, really strong, really fast football players.
Speed.
That's what we're going to build.
I'm going to build on speed.
Right. We're going to, you know, you make a decision, right? Whatever it is. And then on draft day, you start making exceptions. Well, you know, this guy, he's not as fast as we wanted, and, you know, da-da-da, right? Next thing you know, you got a guy that's as fast as you wanted, and you do it again. And you do it again, and you do it again, and you keep doing that for several years. Well, chances are your football team is going to look nothing like what you intended. You're going to have them slow. They're not strong. They're not fast. Whatever it happened to be, it's almost the exact opposite.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're losing. It just means you don't have the team that you originally thought you were going to have. And that's what happens with the financial advisors. And what's interesting, I was listening to a podcast a couple of months ago. I've drawn a blank. I can't remember who it was. But they had done a study, and it talked about how a lot of advisors, when they first start out, you know, they're taught all the same basics, right? Call everybody, you know, don't say no to anybody, because you got to survive, right? You got to pay the bills, right?
Make a list of the 200 names, attack them all.
Hit them hard, right? Hit them fast. If they get up, hit them again, right? And you go after them. You actually have a reasonably good survival rate, but you hit a wall in about 2 years. Because what happens is everybody you've already talked to already just sees you as a kind of a general financial advisor. And nothing really wrong with that. But the problem is you're not standing out in a crowd. So now this starts to talk about the idea of branding. The same study was interviewing other advisors who had really set their mark, you know, put a marker out there, said, I mainly work with business owners or teachers or whatever it is, right? They kind of staked their claim. They had more trouble surviving. But those who did, by year three, they were doing at least twice as much production. And in year four, five, six, I mean, it just exploded. So the specialist, it does make sense to do it. It's just win.
Right.
It's win. If you do it from day one, you better have a nice bankroll.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be kind of tough, right?
You have to be disciplined. Absolutely. So let me just kind of enlighten that or reiterate that and reinforce that, if you will. One of our advisors, recent podcast, right out of the gate, dedicated his practice to solely focusing on and being an expert in long-term care planning. Mm-hmm. And it took a year and a half to 2 years before he got through the survival phase. Well, that takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of dedication. And
a lot of room on your credit card.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's part of it. But today, his firm has stayed true to that original plan, and it is a seven-figure firm today, just focusing on and being an expert in long-term care planning. So kudos to him. But to that, what percentage of advisors, by and large, does he represent? It's a small number.
I can't picture better than 5% if he's that focused and making that kind of money. That's a pretty small niche.
Yeah.
You know, which is, you know, more so pity. I mean, if every financial advisor out there just took a stand and said, this is who I can serve best. And this is, you know, this oddly enough gets me in trouble with advisors. When I'm talking to somebody about getting more focused about their business, they hear the words and they know it and they've heard it before. You know, I'm not the first person that's ever said that, right? I mean, everybody says that. The problem is to actually do it. In their mind, it's a pain. It's a pain in the neck. In fact, I just put out a blog today. You know, I send out, you know, a bunch of stuff every week. And it's all about segmenting your book so that you can figure out who your ideal clients are and really focus in on them and build your whole business around it, et cetera, et cetera. But the effort it takes to do that is painful. There's a pain threshold.
Yeah.
To get specific. The sooner you do it, the better.
A lot of us are one of the things that draws us to financial planning or insurance selling or what have you is sales. It is sales. It's a sales model. And the one thing that's hard for any salesperson is to tell them you got to turn away clients, turn away at a sale.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to be disciplined and focus in a given segment of the population, right, that means I'm invariably going to be turning away people, you know?
Yes and no.
Okay.
Put it this way. Yeah. Well, let's look at it from, if you were, let's say, a doctor, a surgeon specifically, and you were really good. I mean, top of your game. Maybe you're a knee surgeon. You might have billboards on the highway, right? People, I mean, I see them all the time. I go driving around and I see our LASIK surgery, eye surgery. Yeah.
Right.
You know, you see those stuff and it's everywhere. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, it's a knee. It's not a brain. I mean, no disrespect to a knee surgeon, but, you know, if I was a surgeon, if I was that smart, I'd want to be a brain surgeon, right? Because it's more complex and the stakes are higher, right?
Yeah.
But do you think the knee surgeon can do a brain surgery? Probably not. But the brain surgeon can do the knee surgery. I bet you. So think about it. If you're an advisor who really is focused, say, on business owners, people that have, you know, all kinds of moving parts. I mean, you name it. They need insurance. They need investments. They need this. They need that. Whatever. They need all kinds of consulting. They probably have a CPA. If you're that good, do you have to turn somebody away that doesn't need all your services? No, you don't have to. Yeah. But you know you can make a bigger impact on that person, that business owner who has all those moving parts. So do you have to turn somebody away? No. If they can pay the fees that you are needing to charge, right, to create a really great business, whatever that figure is, maybe it's $10,000 a year, maybe it's $20,000, who cares, right? That's up to you. But if somebody comes to you and they got a simple situation and they really want to work with you and they can pay the fees that you can pay, you don't have to say no to them just because you happen to work with top business owners.
Yeah.
But you also know that every single person that's on your, you know, in your business, there's a certain service liability, right? You always have to work with that person. You got to take their phone call, whatever it is, right? So you just have to ask yourself, is this going to throw me off from a business standpoint by taking this person in? Now, if they don't need a lot of help, you could argue, well, probably they won't. They probably won't throw you off. But what if they do have a lot of needs and you're just not really suited to help them? The knee surgeon does not do brain surgeries.
Right.
That's when you do say no. But you say come one, come all to everybody that needs the knee surgery. Right. So that's why I say yes and no. It doesn't hurt you to put a wall up there. And imagine this too. Let's flip this over a little bit from a client standpoint. If a client comes to you and you're really not suited to serve them very well for whatever reason, and you take their business, is that fair?
Well, I would say no, you're not, because you're not fulfilling their needs.
You're not fulfilling the way they probably deserve.
Correct.
And it's not that you can't do it. It's that you don't really want to do it. And that undercurrent makes the unfairness, because when somebody doesn't want to do something, they just don't do it very well.
Right. Right.
You have to incentivize yourself.
Yeah.
To perform the way you want to perform.
Right. So, which is a good segue into the D, which is determine. You, in your ideal plan process, you have the steps where I determine whether I'm a general advisor, a financial planner, a wealth manager, or a family office. And so clearly you have steps or questions that help an advisor determine where they are and where they want to go. Mm-hmm. when I look at this, I think, okay, I think most advisors would just automatically kind of migrate or navigate to, I want to be a wealth manager or a family office. Do I really?
It sounds good.
It sounds exactly. It sounds like that's where I want to live.
Yeah. That's the space a lot of people want to live. Yeah. But they don't necessarily know what goes into it.
Yeah. So let's kind of talk through that, you know, what it means to be the general advisor.
Sure.
Versus a financial planner and so on and so forth. Let's just talk a little bit about what each of those are. Let's define that. And create some, maybe come up with some ideas where advantage, disadvantages to both. And sure. I don't think there's a negative to any one of these.
There's not. There's really truly not. There's no disadvantage. There's disadvantages in depending on where you want to go. That's the only disadvantage.
Okay.
It's like you wouldn't take, like I drive a Ford Expedition, seats eight, you know, it's on an F-150 chassis powertrain. I can pull a boat and have eight people in the car. Would I take that to go race a Ferrari? No, there's an inherent disadvantage, right?
Right, right.
But let's see that Ferrari try to pull my boat. Ain't going to happen, right? So there's advantages and disadvantages, right? You drive what it is that you want to drive, right? You are the person you want to be, unless you want to get better, right? Can you challenge yourself? So here's the thing, and no disrespect to, you know, a generalist advisor. The biggest advantage, a classic definition of a generalist advisor is that most of what you do is very kind of product solution driven, meaning somebody wants to build an estate. Somebody wants to build their net worth. What's the first thing they're going to do? They're not necessarily going to look to an expert who's, you know, sitting there, whatever. It's kind of like the brain surgeon, right? You don't need to go to the brain surgeon just because you need a Band-Aid on your arm, right? So if I can stretch that analogy just a little bit, that's kind of the way I look at it. The generalist advisor typically has a lot of product-driven solutions. Again, nothing wrong with that.
Right.
The vast majority of the industry is still investments.
Right.
And insurance, as you would clearly know, right? That's exactly what you do. So right. If somebody does that for a living, there's nothing wrong with that. You're serving the client, you're taking care of them, you're helping them build an estate or maybe protect themselves. Right, by taking on the risk management or even a portfolio that's less risk,
right,
bonds, et cetera. Right, there's not a lot of planning involved. Typically, you don't have to do a lot of planning.
Right,
and I know a lot of advisors that are huge producers. I mean, $1 million, $2 million producers, and they are 100% basically a stockbroker.
Right,
and more power to them. They serve their clients well. Nothing wrong with that. Okay. The issue is the barrier to entry is focused on the product knowledge alone. That's really about it. You don't have to be a planner. So there's not a lot of barrier to entry. The problem is it's going to be harder for you to differentiate yourself. This goes back to the concept that a lot of advisors, especially in those first few years, you know, you have a greater survivability rate because you're a generalist. You're not turning anybody away. You're taking everybody. You can do anything for everybody, right? Jack of all trades. Those who start to specialize, though, typically specialize because they know something. They know something specific about the market, and that usually translates to a financial planning vision, right? Some sort of overall plan-based solution. That's why, 1974, they launched the CFP program. By the early 1980s, that was still really just in its infancy.
Wow.
But today, they're advertising on TV. You see the ad, CFP, CFP. Why? Because it means you know a lot more. You're more capable. You can solve problems in an overall big vision. So, yes, am I a big fan of planning? Yeah, absolutely. But it also allows you to start to specialize. It starts to show that you have some ability to target yourself, and that's where you're going to grow. So the general advisor's got an advantage in that you can start, as soon as you learn how to do some money management.
Right.
You get access to products. So that's a very inherent advantage. The disadvantage is harder to differentiate. It's harder to upmarket. The vast majority of people that I've worked with that are starting out like that immediately try to get their RIA license so they can start doing asset management and they start doing planning.
Right.
Those are the two things that they start to flip, immediately, is to try to get upscale, basically start getting upmarket.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then what about the wealth manager and into the family office? What's the difference between a wealth manager, financial planner? And
When you step into the role of the CFP or the planner, you don't necessarily have to get the CFP designation, but you certainly should start doing planning. If you're doing RIA work, asset management ties very nicely anyway. If you're going to get paid forever, it's really easy to explain that to a client if you're their advisor forever, right? You're building a plan that's forever. You're adjusting it. You're meeting with them on a quarterly basis. So it kind of just goes very nicely with, you know, the whole CFP program and the whole attitude of doing planning for a fee. In fact, it's easier to put the planning fees embedded right into the AUM. That's traditional, right? For 30 years, people have been doing that. Right. So that to me is the next step up. Now, the only disadvantage is, of course, there's ongoing education requirements, CEs, et cetera. You still have to step up, right? It's more training. It's more experience that you need to do. So is that a big disadvantage? Not really. I mean, this is your career.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're only going to do this for a year or two, don't bother. But I mean, if you're going to do this for 20 years, yeah, why not? Right.
Right. Exactly.
Why not put the time into it? So the next step up is the wealth manager. So this is where you really get a big differentiation. And I like to share this, this analogy, but a lot of people think that a wealth manager is a lot like calling a garage sale an estate sale. Have you ever just driven around the neighborhood and you get kind of, you know, sucked into going to a garage sale, yard sale, whatever they call it?
Yeah.
But it's, but the sign before you made the turn, right, it said estate sale, and you show up and it's just a yard sale.
Right.
You know, there's a difference, right? With an estate sale, somebody died.
Right.
Somebody died. I've been the executor several times in my family, unfortunately. You get old enough, that happens. But when one of the blessings, I guess, of living long enough is you tend to bury all your relatives. So, you know, hooray for that, I guess. But I joke. But here's the thing. When you do an estate sale, you're clearing out the house.
Right.
You're selling everything. All, I mean, the refrigerator, the whatever.
Everything. I mean, you're opening the house. You're getting rid of, you're liquidating what's in the house.
And you often will hire somebody to do that.
Right.
Because it's bigger dollars. This isn't a rummage sale. This isn't just, what am I going to do with that old, whatever, that workout equipment that I forgot about 20 years ago. This right. is stuff that actually counts, right? It's part of the estate. So the way the reason I say that is simply a lot of financial advisors think that wealth manager is just a fancy word for money management. That it's just a fancy word for money management. It's not. What it means is you're doing lifelong planning, but even more importantly, you're factoring all the elements of a person's life. So their taxation, their legal, you name it, risk management. So the best wealth
planning, manager, insurance, all of that.
Everything. Everything.
Yeah, it's not just anecdotally professing the self that you're a comprehensive financial planner and holistic and what have you. Wealth manager embodies all aspects of the financial, insurance, investment, tax, estate
plan. You name it.
But yeah.
Anything that a client would need. So I don't know about you, but I don't know too many people that are a financial advisor and a CPA and a lawyer, an estate planning attorney. In fact, none.
Very, very, yeah, none.
33 years I've been in the industry. 30, oh my God, it'll be almost 35 years in this industry. I've never met anybody that had right. all three of those all designations. Three.
Right.
And that doesn't even count insurance or any other kind of specialty. So how are you supposed to do all of those things if you're a one-man shop? Forget it. It screams out teamwork.
Right.
So the easiest test to find out if you're a wealth manager is who's on your team. How many CPAs do you know? How many attorneys do you know? How many insurance experts do you know? And I don't mean know them because you found their name, you know, online. I mean, you know them. You work with them. You
right. There's a true them. Strategic partnership. There's a working relationship. There's a process within your practice.
You meet fairly regularly. And as I like to say with my clients, and I put up my little air quotes here, for the benefit of the client. And I mean that in a sense that you got to learn that phrase. If you're a financial advisor and you want to be a wealth manager, you have to understand how to deliver for the benefit of the client. It's not just a tagline. It's not a throwaway.
Right.
So you have to meet with other people. You better know their CPA. And how hard is that anyway? How hard is it to find out who your clients work with? Ask. Right. Ask.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who do they work with? Ask them what they think of their CPA. What do they think about this or that or whatever? Right. And you can start to build a team. So when you think about the business model, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of focused on this right now, so I'm kind of going a little deeper than you might have wanted, but to me, that's a fundamental difference. It's like, again, the jump between the knee surgeon and the brain surgeon.
Right.
Or you might even argue it's the difference between a student in medical school and a brain surgeon. That's how big the jump is. If you're not forming teams with other professionals, and I could talk all day of all the benefits, it's not just good for the client. It's good for you. It's good for your business. I mean, you do, put it this way, people judge you by the company you keep.
Yeah, I would imagine what from a general advisor up and to and through wealth manager into becoming a family office, you're definitely moving the needle towards higher net worth clients.
And they're going to expect it.
You're accessing mail, you're gaining more knowledge, there's a number of things that your business journey requires for that to take place.
It's the ultimate evolution of the business.
Right.
I tell people, anybody that's willing to hear it, this is going to keep us relevant in this whole process. What's going to keep us relevant as individuals in the face of staggering competition. Yeah. And I don't mean just from other individuals. I mean, all the online, the onslaught, if you will, of robo advisors and the gearing up of Fidelity and Schwab and everybody else, no disrespect intended, but they're going to eat our lunch if we don't step up. I feel sorry for the guy who just wants to be a generalist, just a general advisor. I think that's almost like what you'd call an abandoned asset or legacy asset. It's a legacy business model.
Right.
It's a leftover to the past. Feel free to edit all that out if you think it's going to offend all your listeners.
No. This is, honesty is, we always appreciate it. And look, if nothing else, I could tell you, I'm two things, honest and direct. There's no need to adjust that on any level. Let's move on to evaluate your skills, because this, that's, to being honest and direct, this is another very, I would think this is another challenging component of the conversation for an advisor, is to really evaluate my skills and proficiencies, really take a good hard look at not just my practice, but also me as a person and as an advisor, and honor strengths, recognize deficiencies. The seven areas, correct me if I'm wrong, are branding, number one, marketing, business development, the sales process or processes within my practice, practice management, client relationships, and business optimization.
Yes.
So those are the... Right.
The seven critical business elements. I don't know if there's anything magical about the number seven, but I think it's easy to use that as kind of a little bit of a catch-all in some of the areas. But, when you go back to your original concept of, if you're a new advisor, what do? Right. You just want to survive. You got to make some money somehow. So, but even back in 1987, when I was a newbie, every single advisor in that building had the same problem, and they said it over and over and over again. How do I differentiate? How do I differentiate? They were all generalists. There was a handful of CFPs. The asset management business didn't even exist back then to speak of. And that was the big change, right? That was kind of the new shiny new object, right? That started to change. But people thought that the only way to differentiate was to talk about their performance. Well, we kind of learned the hard way that doesn't really do much. So if you're going to step up and evaluate yourself, let's say you want to become a family office. Well, you kind of got to be a wealth manager first before you'll even get to that point. The only real difference between the two is whether you're starting to bring some of those, support people, the corollary, whatever you want to call it, these other partners in-house. To bring them in. And so dollar for dollar, the sweet spot still is the wealth manager, because you can get the same kinds of clients, you can charge well, but you keep everybody in their own offices. So there's some benefits to that. And, there's definitely advantages and disadvantages. You might lose a little control, but you got more people to play with, right? Because you're not, the moment you hire a CPA into your office, no other CPA is going to want to talk to you. Why would they? They think you're just, you know, competition. So they're not going to do that. So once you go to wealth manager, you're kind of committed, but it's a good model. It works and you can have very, very large clients. But getting back to the idea of the evaluation proficiencies, you really do need to be honest with yourself. That's why I built the system. That's why I built an online process. And what I discovered is as people go through it, and just for the listeners' benefit that have not been on there, what you're really doing is you're asking a battery of questions and is asking you different subsections or building blocks of each category. So branding, marketing, et cetera, right? Each one has a number of building blocks and it's on a scale of 1 to 5, how good are you? But instead of just taking a wild guess and saying, well, I'm gonna give myself a 3 because I haven't given myself a 3 in a while, there's literally a written description of levels of proficiency, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So you pick the statement that's most accurate of where you are today. So for instance, let's use branding. If you're looking at branding and you are really a generalist, you have no idea who your ideal client ought to be. Well, guess what? That's a 1. And that's what the little box would say. As you know this, you've already been through it. But the point is that when you start to go through these different areas, whatever the subject, whether it's your sales process and it's about, you know, your ability to convert, it stands out, it's so good, people give you referrals. Whether it's a practice management issue, you've started to build out your financial planning, your advanced planning and your team, or it's a client relationship issue and you're giving a wow factor to your clients. You know, you get big money events all the time, whatever it happens to be. As you go through that, you start to realize, one, you're probably not as good as you wish you were. And second, you start to see how these things really interconnect. You start to realize that if I have a kind of a deficiency in certain areas, it's going to be very difficult for me to become highly proficient someplace else. Mm. That's the biggest takeaway I get from people all the time, because I ask them, you know, what's the biggest takeaway, right? And they start to say, I started to realize how connected these things are.
Right, right. Yeah, that's very interesting. Because, you know, you look at branding and marketing, obviously you could generically say, okay, well, those go hand in hand. Maybe they do and they don't, right? They are specific subsets of my business, but how does marketing coincide with client relationships or business optimization?
And how is it affected?
Yeah.
Your client relationships can be affected by marketing because you're setting the standard, right? You're creating a message to the world that's very specific that says, if you work with us, this is what you should expect. That's part of your marketing.
Right.
That's part of your messaging. That's part of your credibility.
The perfect example of this, the very basic example of this, I mean, this makes it actually very clear in how directly related they are. If all my marketing subliminally caters to cat owners, but yet I'm selling dog food,
right?
I find myself in misalignment, right, with who my client relationships are. I look, all my marketing is to one thing, but yet I look at my client relationships, it's something completely separate. We've got to be consistent, and so does the brand. The brand subliminally, right, psychologically, has to connect from a marketing perspective to the people that I want to attract. Well, how do I do that?
You know, the easiest thing to do is to start thinking about, if you're already in the business and you've been at it for a while, say 5 years or more, look at your top clients today. I think it's Ron Carson who said this, who's obviously a big name in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I think he said it, your clients are a reflection of you. Your clients are a reflection of you. Meaning, the people that you kind of hang out with the most are people that seem a lot like you. I mean, you know, your friends, basically. It's almost like you've cloned yourself, right? So when you think about your best clients, what is it about them that you like? What is it that they do for a living, perhaps? What do you have an affinity for? You can't fake this. This is your own career. This is your own business. Why would you lie to yourself?
Yeah.
If you really don't like working with engineers, don't work with engineers.
Right, right. Take a look at the top 5% of your clients or top 10% of your clients. How did that relationship engage? How does it exist today? Right? How do you attract them? How do you scale that?
How did they learn about you in the first place? Were they a cold call, or did you find them some other way? So when you start to dissect who your best clients are, and there's a lot of people out there, and I know you know this phrase, 80-20 rule, right? 80% of your revenue comes from 20% of your book, right? There's a lot of advisors, that's still their life.
Right.
So, okay, well, if that's the case, then you ought to know who to talk to.
Right.
So what I have is a process that will allow you to basically figure out how to interview these people, how to identify. And it's very kind of left brain. It's not a hard thing to follow. I mean, it's just step by step. But all you got to do is interview these people. Now, I didn't invent this idea. I mean, this is old as the hills. There's plenty of coaching firms that will tell you, interview your top clients, right? Why? Because you want to figure out why they're your top client.
Yeah, what they eat, what they sleep, how they sleep, where they go, what they do, who their friends are, right? Dive into that. Better understand.
Dive in. Learn about their job. Learn about their industry. Learn what they read. You know, again, nothing new here. This is nothing new. Everybody's heard this, but you know what? There's a lot of people that are still not doing it. And that's where I come in on the coaching side. My job is to help you to do stuff that you probably already know you should be doing. You just haven't been doing it, right? So if we can just get people to think about who their best clients are, it's a heck of a lot easier to realize that their branding is going to suffer until they figure out who their best clients are.
Yeah, I think it's twofold. It's really helping entrepreneurs and advisors be intentional about their practice, which is what this does directly. And then two, it's accountability. As you said, many of us are entrepreneurs. We're at one-man bands. We're out on an island. Who is really keeping us accountable? Having that relationship that could exist unbiasedly so provides tremendous value to what it is that I'm really trying to achieve and the success I'm trying to obtain. And part of that is really identifying the journey I'm on and is it on course?
It's an
easier said than done, you know?
I know.
I'd like to take a look at two things too. What is business development? And what is practice management? How are they different?
Yeah, I look at it, there's kind of a hierarchy. The branding is who you are. It's your identifier. So it's almost like somebody said this the other day. I don't know where I saw it. It's like a handle on a suitcase, right? The business is the suitcase, but the handle is you and your name, right? So somehow or another, people just got to get a handle on you, quote unquote, right? They got to understand how to think about you. They need to think about how to talk about you, et cetera, right? So even your website should basically say, these are the kinds of people we help. And it should be front and center. Because people that come to your website, what are they looking for, right? They want validation. They want to know you exist. They want to know, are you credible? And should I work with you? That's it. It's only a handful of things a website's supposed to do, and those are basically it, right? So your brand has to be on everything, right? It's just like Coca-Cola's logo. The moment you see it, you know who they are. You already have ideas about who they are. You got an image, right?
Right.
When you get into marketing, you're mobilizing. You're reinforcing. You're creating credibility. Or as they say in Marketing 130 at San Jose State in 1988, creating an environment that's conducive to sales, right? I was a marketing minor, so that's how I knew that. So you're creating an environment that is conducive to sales. So you're taking your brand and you're starting to mobilize it. I like to call it mobilizing your message. And all that means is somehow or another, what you do for a living, who you serve, what you do for them, the positioning statement, all that marketing, jibber jabber that we all know all these terms for. You're taking your positioning statement and you're mobilizing it. Business development is finding somebody to hear it. Somebody has to hear that message. It doesn't do you a lot of good to get out a bullhorn and go climb up on the top of the tallest ladder and start screaming out to the world who you serve best if there's literally no one within hearing range.
Right.
You can get a taller ladder and they still can't hear you.
Right. That's a great example or a great analogy.
You have to find somebody who wants to hear it. So business development is kind of, I hate to say it, that's the hard part, right? This is where most advisors fail miserably. It's not sales. Business development is finding business, somebody to listen to you. Sales is conversion. That's when you turn them into a client.
Right.
So don't confuse those guys, right? And marketing is not business development. That's your messaging. That's your brand. Get it out there. Make a credibility, right? So social media and podcasts are a form of marketing. But somebody's got to hear it.
Right.
So who are you going to go after? So in my coursework, first thing we do is, if you're going to interview some of your top clients, guess what? Ask them what they read. What associations do they belong to? Do they have any kind of clubs, or are they in anything, right? You know, if you know them well, you probably know the stuff that's on their walls, right? What's on their walls? Do they have any emblems? Do they have anything at all that makes you think they're connected to the rest of the world? If they are, who should I be talking to in that group to maybe get an audience? Can I tailor my message to that audience? Can I get it out there? This is the foundation of doing webinars and seminars, any kind of hosting of events.
Right.
Right. And who can I find within business development that'll become an advocate for me? Referrals. Most advice, I don't know about your data source, or, you know, but I just kind of read what's out there in the funny pages, right? I never really know when I see a study if it's accurate or not, because there's a lot of bias in studies. But most advisors, in my humble opinion, are still waiting for the phone to ring. They're waiting for a referral to come.
Right.
What are you doing about it?
Yeah, yeah. As opposed to having a plan that actually creates raving fans. I mean, that's the ultimate identifier of referrals and introductions is, no. I've gotten to the point where I've got clients who feel not only confident, but they become almost energized.
They become almost a crusader, as we call it.
And that's a challenging thing in the financial planning space. I mean, there's certain other areas and aspects of product, consumer goods, what have you. It's very easy to become a raving fan.
Yeah. You know, and there's plenty of stuff. I mean, if I were to ask you, who's your favorite company, you probably have somebody. I mean, who is it? Do you have a favorite company that you love working with?
Insurance wise, I mean,
anybody, I don't care if it's a tire shop. Do you have a favorite company?
Oh gosh, there's a number of companies I love. I mean, I love Nordstrom. I would strongly encourage, as an organization, I could go on as a raving fan about them.
And you probably have, right? How many people have you told about Nordstrom, or an experience you had at Nordstrom?
It's easier to do. And that's the thing. And in the financial planning world, it's, for whatever reason, there's a stigma a little bit around consumers being able to express their positivity towards their advisor or management firm, you know? Yeah. But that's a great challenge. How do I get to that point? How do I build upon the best clients that I do have and promote an environment that allows them to say, Richard Boone is fantastic, you know, and here's why he's fantastic. This is why you should go meet with them.
You owe it to yourself to have a conversation, you know, that kind of thing, right? I've got a lot of my people that are getting more referrals now just in the last 3-4 months than they had in the last 2 years. Why? Because they're doing the work that you have to do to turn people into raving fans. And you have to ask.
Right.
You have to ask for introductions. And I know there's people out there that kind of cringe, and I've blogged on this subject.
100%. Absolutely.
If you're not asking, somebody else is, right? And there's plenty of studies that I've seen that show the vast majority of clients are actually willing to make an introduction, and they just are never asked. Like 80%. It's a ridiculously high number.
Right.
And what's funny about it is, you know, that's kind of one of the, just the standard building blocks of business development. So I take people through the branding and then the marketing and then the business development. Sales process is really all about conversion. How do you handle your pipeline? How do you do your face-to-face, you know, with somebody? What kind of discovery meeting do you run? What does it look like? And what does your process overall look like to try to turn these people into clients?
Right.
Then you get into practice management, and now it's all about, okay, financial planning, advanced planning, professional team building, technology, workflows. You know, do you even have standard operating procedures? I got a guy who wants to hire an assistant, and I think he's going to do a virtual assistant. There's a company out there that I know of that I've heard some good things. You know, some of my clients have used that actually work well with financial advisors, and they're just, you know, it's all virtual.
Yeah, I want to hire. Really, I don't even have a job description. So how am I going to tell this person what to do? And I get so frustrated and upset when they're not doing what it is I want them to do, but I never put it in writing.
And you couldn't train them anyway, right? If you don't know your own standard operating procedures, if you don't have a workflow, I mean, excuse me for living, but that's going to be a tough call to expect that assistant or whoever it is, that CSA person, that's going to be a hell of a time for them.
Right.
To do what you want them to do.
Right.
And if how that goes, right? If you're not seeing eye to eye with the person, eventually the relationship falls apart. So that's just,
so that, you know, we're through five systems, you know, account management platforms, What kind of fintech solutions am I using within my process practice, and knowing what that process is along the way and the steps. What do we do first? What do we do second? What are we doing for our existing clients? Are we sending, how are we tracking birthday cards and anniversaries and these kinds of things?
How does the client relationship management end up in your practice management, right? What, it isn't just the service stuff, right? It's how are you dealing with, how are you creating a wow?
Right.
How are you acknowledging? I got to do a shout out. There's a lady by the name of Julie Sendelbach, and I worked with her at my old firm for I don't know how many years, and one of the best coaches I've ever met. And she used to say, what are you doing to acknowledge the things that are most important? If you're a financial advisor and you're out there working with clients, how do you know what's most important to these people? What is it in their life? It's usually things having to do with their lifestyle, their relationships, and their passions. So a passion could be, you know, maybe they're a crazy fanboy of the San Francisco 49ers like I am. And I was absolutely devastated when they blew it in the Super Bowl a year or two ago.
Yeah.
And 7 or 8 years before that, they blew it in the Super Bowl. I mean, that's a life sentence, seeing your team lose the Super Bowl, believe me.
Right. As a fan,
you talk about the 49ers with me. If you're any kind of fan of the 49ers, we're going to be friends for life. Right. It's simple as that. So imagine if you're finding that out about every one of your clients, what really gets them going.
Yeah.
And you acknowledge that and you make that part of your business model and you build that into your standing operating procedures, your workflows and your assistants, your staff know it. And they're building systems around it to make it easier for you to acknowledge the things that are most important to your clients. Holy cow. You want to solve some of your business development problems? You want to get more referrals? You want to turn people into raving fans? I just told you how.
Yeah, that's great. That's good. That's great. That's good stuff. And then last but not least, right? The seventh.
Business optimization. To optimize something is to get the most out of it. That's it. That's all it means to optimize something. So you got partners, possibly, maybe you do, maybe you don't, staff, advisors, maybe fellow advisors, juniors, whatever you want to call it. Then you get into other areas like your profitability, your service matrix, which you can never really, I can't tell you enough how important it is to know your service matrix. You cannot segment your book. You cannot release inappropriate clients. You cannot focus on your ideal clients if you don't know what your service matrix should be. If you can't even tell me what it is now, you got a problem. Fixing it and making it optimal, no pun intended, is really the key.
Yeah.
Because you can build your whole business model around the service matrix. Last but not least, you get into succession planning, exit planning, and then work-life balance.
Right.
Are you working too much? So when I take people through this, you know, there's a lot. I mean, we could talk all day about each one of those building blocks. But
yeah, and that's a hard one too, because a lot of the times it becomes control and just really the unwillingness to be honest with where I'm spending my time and how I'm spending my time, and willing to acknowledge that there is an alternative solution that'll allow me more freedom in life, more time to be focused on client development, client relationships, giving up a certain percentage of revenue to hire somebody to bring them into the practice.
And if you don't have a business, you have a practice.
Right. Yeah. And that's
a difference.
It's a very, very big difference. And so that I would say that's a very challenging, honest.
It should be the hardest one. It should be the hardest of the seven critical business elements, because if you're now, obviously, if you don't have any partners, you don't have any staff, you don't have an advisor, you're going to mark 1-1-1, right? 3 in a row. So you're going to get a really lousy score on that report in a hurry just because of that section.
Yeah. On the idea.
You know what? But you know what? If you don't have anybody else in your business, you know, you really are on your own. I mean, this goes back to 1980 something, you know, when I first got in business, I realized there's 35 guys in this office. And every one of them's alone, except for the three partners who actually did work together and stuff. But everybody else was basically a loner inside of an office. So it was 35 silos. that's not a business.
Right.
That's a Regis, you know, office center where you're renting executive office space.
Yeah.
And you're bumping into each other in the hallway and right. at the coffee pot.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. Right. And guess what? A lot of advisors out there, they're still living that lifestyle. So let me give you one quickie solution on business optimization. I have to share this. When people think about how they spend their time, the easiest solution, I know this sounds like, what decade were you born in, Rich? You know, 1860, right? But I swear to God, this works. Just grab a pen and paper, ideally graph paper or line paper, and start time logging. Time logging. Just write it down. How are you spending your day? Seriously, just write it down. And don't be judgmental. And don't cheat. You're not lying. You're not trying to make yourself look good. You're not doing it. It's not for somebody else. It's for you. So just be honest. Did you just really spend an hour and a half playing on the internet?
Right.
Pretending to work? Did you just spend 20 minutes, you know, on the phone dealing with some nonsense thing that you could have done after work? Did you this? Did you that? Right? That's all you're doing. You're just trying to give yourself a medium to be honest. Did you really spend only 1 hour all week on business development? You have to put some categories in there. Where did right. you spend your time? Did you work on your business at all? Or were you just all reaction the whole time? I've got a guy, fairly new client, big hitter, big producer, basically family office. He spends 90% of his time just reacting. And he knows it. And he knows it. That's why he hired me.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting here thinking, okay, if you can be that successful and still spend all your time reacting, you must be pretty darn good when you're busy, right?
Yeah.
Imagine if we just moved 10% instead of only 10% of your time being proactive, if it was 20, if we just doubled that, what would your business look like?
Right. No.
So start with that.
That's a very, very good point. And I would encourage, start with a day, but ultimately you do it over the course of a 5-day work week.
I would do it over about 2 weeks, actually.
Okay.
To get a good pattern to really see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, even if I don't do anything with it after the 2 weeks, I would have discovered a lot internally, and I don't need to share that with anybody, right? It's like,
yours.
I can look at that myself over those 10 working days and say, oh my gosh, I'm swiping.
Did I really do that?
Yeah.
Did I really online take 2 hours for lunch?
Whatever it was.
Right. It's unbelievable. What the truth will set you free, right?
Yeah.
All it is truth.
That's great.
And I've had guys that, you know, I started doing this with because they were, you know, stressed out or whatever. And it's like,
I don't have enough time. I just,
the oldest excuse in the book. I don't have enough time.
Right.
You know, this will solve that in a hurry because you'll find out how many hours.
Awareness, recognition, and discipline.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. So
easier said than done. Works. This was great. This was very, very helpful, informative. Thank you, Rich, for coming on.
Hey,
how do people reach out to you? How do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, Rich at idealplancoaching.com. I strongly urge you to go on the website. There's free stuff. I've got the Ideal Plan Builder on there, the link for that. It's free. Take you about an hour, maybe an hour and a half, depending on, you know, how serious you take it. And no disrespect to people that got through it fast. But if you really spend the time and think about it, it'll probably take you, you know, at least an hour.
Right.
And then there's also a free trial of my coaching platform, the digital coaching platform. And then, of course, I do live coaching. So just pick up the phone and call me. You can call 800-630-1590. And
the website, idealplancoaching.com.
Yep. Idealplancoaching.com.
Fantastic. We appreciate you.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you so much for having me here. This has been a lot of fun. It's nice to be on this side of the podcast too.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you coming on as guest. Would love to have you on to another show down the road.
Great. Thanks.
Cheers.